Here to my right, Mr. Reinhold Niebuhr, Mr. Thurgood Marshall, and Mr. Norman Thomas. Mr. Niebuhr, would you begin us by a comment on this, which is the kind of thing that so interests, let's say, my colleagues at the university. Some 20 or 30 years ago, thoughtful, liberal-minded Americans were very hopeful. They thought if we gave people more food, more clothing, more housing, if we cut down discrimination in American life, a better country would emerge. We've done a number of those things, at least to some extent, and now this same thoughtful, liberal-minded group, in many cases, is very disillusioned and very worried. As we all know, they say we produced an affluent, a conformist, a banal American society. Would you comment on that?
Well, my first reaction, Mr. Goldman, would be to say that this is a proof that cynics and pessimists are disappointed sentimentalists. We were all sentimentalists, I think, in the 30s. The historian May, in his book, The End of American Innocence, he defines the end of innocency right in 1910. I think it was later than that. I think it was around 1930. I think the end of American innocence was between the Great Depression and the Second World War. Now, you say 20 or 30 years. I'll say 30 years. In the 30s, I'd say all so-called idealists had rather simple answers to very complex and puzzling problems. And we thought that history moved rather easily toward the goals that we desired.
Didn't you yourself think it was a little simpler then?
Oh, absolutely. I had all the illusions of the 30s. For instance, I remember being in student movements where we organized the first interracial student meetings on South. We thought that these would solve the race problem.
Right.
And I remember that we thought that you could solve the economic problem by various what I would now regard utopian schemes. Now, the reason I think that this isn't work is not because we're absolutely sunk in depravity in an affluent society, but for two reasons. One is that history moves much more slowly, whether it's on the race issue or the economic issue or the war issue, than any of us imagined. And secondly, that the way that you solve the problems raise new problems that you hadn't anticipated.
And Mr. Thomas, would you say you had illusions in the 30s, too?
Apparently not as many. I didn't have any too great confidence. On the contrary, I thought things went faster than I expected between 1933 and 38.
They actually have, do I understand you've gone faster than
you expected? Gone faster than I then expected. I was terribly gloomy in this period between the time when Roosevelt got his popular majority and the time when he was inaugurated. I never saw working class audiences so utterly cynical. Yes, Roosevelt was elected, but hardly any audience I talked to had any real faith in democracy.
This is 32.
I think there's some mistake here. At least we don't see the same things the same way. I had my great illusions were much earlier. They were before the First World War. And for a little while after the First World War, on the ground that we now knew that that couldn't possibly happen again. Now I am again pretty gloomy. But let me bring it down in a hurry. And in bringing it down, let me show how difficult it is really to generalize. Our feelings and even our rationalizations are so easily affected. I picked up the paper just the other day. It was the same paper. And I read the story of Commander Shepherd and his interview with the press. And I was proud all the way through of America, much as I'd been at the first interviews with Lindbergh when he came back. But the same paper had so many other things to make me so far from being proud. There was the account of the sentencing of the woman lawyer who had confessed to the complete rigging of the quiz shows, and that reminded me of what that seemed to me to mean in American life, that lack of standards.
Well,
it's a very mixed-up kind of a thing. And I rejoiced in that Shepherd interview as restoring a little confidence. I didn't rejoice then to pick up a paper a day or two later and read that the administration has apparently lost interest in civil rights and that the president had promised the governor of Georgia that he would never use troops in the school issue. I would hope with all my heart that there'd be not the slightest need to use troops, that there are other and better ways, but I don't see how a president can keep his oath of office and assure recalcitrants that never, never, never will he do a certain thing to enforce the law. I was never so confused as I am now in what I think.
I think that what bothers, for example, a lot of us sitting in our faculty rooms and looking back at the 30s is that even in the case of something like Shepard, you read about him, we're all thrilled about him, but you read Mr. James Reston's account of why people should be proud of him. He doesn't say we should be proud of him because this is obviously a superior human being in intelligence and brave. He says this shows how good the ordinary fellow is, the middle of his class, married the girl next door, his mother looks like everybody's mother. A kind of worship of mediocrity even coming from James Reston. And this is the kind of thing that in my original question has disillusioned, let us say.
You think he was smiled, that he was worshiping mediocrity? The way I read Reston was that he, like myself, was trying to find something to cheer about. And since he, like myself, or certainly I'll speak for myself, had to believe that it was in mediocrity, it was in ordinary people that you had to find confidence of decency and hope of progress. And since we've been pretty much disappointed by lots of developments, it was a great thing to have Shepard come along. That's the way it was with me. I'm not worshiping mediocrity. I don't think it was an additional virtue for Mr. Shepard to have stood in the middle of his class.
Well, I don't know. I look at it from two different angles. Some minister said last week, I read it in the paper, that we are doing a very good job of shooting out into outer space, but nobody's doing too much about the man's inner mind. And it seems to me that this country, if it's going to take its leadership in the world, we have to get back to this other proposition of taking over the moral leadership, and that's the thing I'm worried about. Just 2 weeks ago, I was in Sierra Leone, Africa, and they weren't too worried about any of these things, even the proposal to shoot or what have you. All they wanted to know was from an American, and as head of the delegation representing President Kennedy, they wanted to know how it happened that their ambassador-elect, Ambassador Fitzjohn, refused service in the Howard Johnson restaurant up in Maryland. And when explained that the restaurant was changing its policy and the due apologies had been made, had very little effect. And I think Herb Block, the cartoonist, a few days thereafter, really hit it on the head of the cartoon of the two dark people standing, waiting to get in the restaurant, and the manager rushing up to the hostess and saying, it's all right, they can come in, they're not Americans. Well, I think that's what we've got to really face.
Well, I talking about Commander Shepard, I don't think that's glorifying mediocrity because he's not a mediocre man, and it's certainly glorifying technical achievement and discipline. Nevertheless, I'm a little worried about the fact that we want to get so much mileage out of the prestige of technical skill. Now, I know that this is inevitable in our contest with communism because the Russians were a backward people, and they've equaled us and then surpassed us in space exploration, so now we're even with them. But when the vice president said in giving the medal to Shepard, he said, we're proud of, above all, that our democratic civilization has produced a man like you. I had an eerie feeling because that's exactly what Khrushchev said to to the spaceman. He said, we're proud of the socialist culture has produced a fine young man like you. Well, there's something not quite in proportion in this, because, and I agree with Mr. Marshall, it's the political and moral leadership that we need vis-a-vis communism, not only on the color issue, although on that too, but on the political moral issue of democracy versus communism. That's why the Cuban thing, I think, was such a disaster that it obscured, particularly in Latin America, that the real issue. And that is whether democracy is a viable instrument of social justice vis-a-vis communism.
I think that a great deal of our trouble is, at least indirectly and part of it directly, due to the fact that ordinary people who were managing pretty well, or would have managed pretty well under the conditions that we thought about in the good years, that is, the years before the First World War, are now subject to such extraordinary strains. A lot of very ugly birds have come home to roost. We are now belatedly finding out how awful was our policy with regard to our colored fellow citizens. It's coming up on us at a moment when we're trying to do better, but not trying half hard enough. The sins have come back to us.
I was refreshing my memory about your life the other day and came across the amusing incident that you, as a boy in Marion, Ohio, used to deliver newspapers, my account said, for Warren G. Harding.
That's true.
Now I'm having
quite a controversy with the president of the college, which by some extraordinary chance was named after him. And the institution which, until recently, with the help of government, was indoctrinating young men in camps with a largely false picture of communism, which identifies communism with almost all social progress, which calls almost everybody interpenetrated by communists, except possibly the Catholic Church.
We talk about this, the problem of moral leadership today. Would you say that that town you grew up in had a moral climate which was any more satisfactory, any more capable of producing the moral leadership we need now than our communities today?
No. If you picked that town as it was then, if they'd slept like Rip and Winkle and you'd wake them up, they would have been probably worse rather than better than the same town would be now.
Is this true all around? Is this Missouri of your boyhood?
I think that's true. One of the optimistic things one can say about our whole country is that, on the whole, we have marched with history. Take, for instance, on the problem of international responsibility. I remember the isolationist, irresponsible days of America. Now, we've been cured of that. I think we've been cured of it because after the Second World War, we got obvious power, and we had just enough sense to know that responsibility goes with power. And this was our salvation. Now, we've done a lot of wrong things with this power, but we're not irresponsible. And in the days of my youth, the whole Middle West, these Middle Western villages, what did they know about the world? What did they care about the world? Well, now, somehow or other, we care. So history moves and informs all of us.
Well, this is where I want to make a point. But the point is, as I think Mr. Niebuhr said, that we don't have moved fast enough. I'll accept the fact that we have learned a responsibility and an interest in the world that we completely lack. But we haven't learned it anything like well enough. We haven't, the public is, I think, behind and not ahead of a Congress that isn't very far advanced, in my judgment, on a whole lot of things. I don't think the public, for instance, it took Eisenhower to tell them the danger of a military-industrial complex, something that I'd been talking about as a garrison state. Eisenhower did it, and the public wasn't particularly affected.
Mr. Marshall, on this question of the timetable, I was very much interested. Do you remember your comments the day you won the great decision in the Supreme Court, by any chance?
Mm-hmm.
I went back and looked them up. You talked about how if anybody violates this decision, we'll have the responsible officers there. And then you asked how long he, that's you, thought it would be before segregation in education was eliminated. Marshall said it might be up to 5 years for the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And predicted that by the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1963, segregation in all its forms would have been eliminated from the nation. Well, of course, the timetable is off. What's happened, Mr. Marshall?
The timetable has completely disappeared. As witness the fact that almost 7 years after the Supreme Court decision, only 6% of the Negroes in the South are integrated. And in a urban community like New Orleans, reasonably decent except segregated, law-abiding, when four little Negro children were admitted to two schools, three in one and one in the other, the legislature went on a rampage, the mobs went on a rampage, everybody acted like it's the most horrible thing that ever happened. So far as I'm concerned, I am completely disappointed with the progress that has been made, and I think it's not only the recalcitrant states themselves. I think in part Perhaps the Negroes hadn't pushed as hard as they should have pushed. But one thing I am certain of, that's the middle group of people, the good people in the South, have simply refused to take over the leadership.
Mr. Goldman, could I ask Mr. Marshall a question about the middle group, the good people in the middle? That refers to the slowness of the integration. Now, I ask this question with full sympathy for the Supreme Court decision and thrilled by it. Nevertheless, what I want to ask is, isn't it true that what has happened since the Supreme Court decision has shown us that the interaction between law and culture is much more difficult than we had imagined? I don't know whether you agree with this, what I want to say next, and that is that however the whip necessary the whip of law is, it seems to have one baneful effect, and that is it polarizes the culture, so that you have the good people, that is, the people that want integration, have become better, they've had the support of law, while the people that oppose it have become worse. And so
the middle group is left out.
Well,
there's another fact. The main fact is the middle group is completely unorganized. Secondly, the middle group in America, and I think this is what has happened over a period of years, you take the middle class, economic class, man that's about to be made vice president, or the young vice president bucking for executive vice president, he's very careful to get out of anything, quote, controversial, end quote.
This is the Negro young man, or the white, both.
Both or either.
Both or either.
That's the organization man he's talking about.
Yeah, and so anything controversial, they stay out of. And that's what's wrong with politics in general in this country, is that those people will not engage in politics. They don't want to get in anything. So on the race problem, they're not going to get involved unless there's some leadership that pushes them. Now, if the president of this corporation or that corporation had been willing to get into the controversy, the vice presidents would have, and the foreman. But it's the power structure that failed to move. And I think that's the responsibility that's got to be met. We criticize the ministers in the South for not taking a position on the school cases.
Yes,
it's not fair to criticize the ministers. Criticize their boards of trustees. Those ministers like to eat
just
like anybody else.
You can criticize them both. you see, I think this puts a finger, though, on what's really the matter. I don't think people as people are worse than they were. In some ways, I think they're more humane, even within my lifetime, in what they want instinctively. But they've been through two world wars that, by the nature of war, produces a degree of suffering unimagined. They live in a world where no longer have they got time. They're not wholly aware of it, but time is now not something that you can look forward to for slow growth. We don't, any of us, know how much time we've got. And what has happened has been that Mr. Niebuhr called the sentimentalities of the 30s, which were more than sentimentalities in my judgment, were partly fulfilled. Our hopes were partly fulfilled, but the hopes weren't big enough ever to deal with a whole situation that hadn't presented itself adequately. That involves some, in many cases, too much disappointment. I don't think that because you didn't get paradise, you therefore say we didn't get anything. But the point is that there is now, in this time of confusion and crisis, no equivalent to what there was earlier in the century. Right or wrong, the church doesn't provide it. You don't have the equivalent of the social gospel, in my opinion, in men's minds to stimulate them. You don't have the equivalent of what socialism did. Not because they were wrong, but because they hadn't been sufficiently thought through, hadn't been sufficiently presented, and aren't now. This is a country without a left. And yet there is a capacity somewhere to do things, as is has been evinced most of all by our colored fellow citizens, the young students, the anonymous students who started the most significant movement that's been started in terms of doing something about it. I mean, the sit-down strikes.
On this question of having time, may I come back a moment to you, Mr. Marshall, on this Negro issue, which all of you men have been emphasizing as one where the moral leadership or moral sensitivity somehow or another of this nation had failed. Mr. James Baldwin, who declared himself not to be a black Muslim, nevertheless spoke in the strongest terms of what he considered the total impatience of the Negro with the present rate of desegregation of American life, and that as a result of that, as I understood him, he was saying that the Negro is giving up, or at least part of the Negro leadership is giving up, on what he pictured to me, at least, as the slow, tortuous processes of legal victories, which you represent. If this is so, of course, it's a very serious situation within America.
Well, it's not that simple. In the first place, the Negroes as a group, and I can speak for them in contrast to people like Mr. Baldwin and some others, because I spend three-fourths of my time down below the Smith and Wesson line. I think you call it the Mason and Dixon line. And as to the slowness of the judicial process, certainly Negroes are impatient. But when you witness that right in the heart of the area where these sit-ins began, North Carolina, it started right in Greensboro, on Sunday at an NAACP meeting in Raleigh, North Carolina, there were some 10,000 people there in the interest of the legal work. They have not given up their support of the legal work, but I have something to do with the legal work. I would be the first one to say that we knew in the beginning, we know now, even clearer, that these problems cannot be solved by the courts alone. I don't criticize the Negroes for their impatience. The trouble with the average person in a democracy, at least in this country, is that they expect the government to do the job for them rather than to do the job themselves. They're the same people that say they don't want a dictatorship, but yet they want government to do what they themselves should do. Certainly, legal work will not solve this problem. The best example is the Lucy case in the University of Alabama. The case was in litigation for 4 years. It went to the Supreme Court either two or three times. It was won every step of the way. The legal battle was complete. Yet not only is Miss Lucy not in the University of Alabama, no Negro is there yet. But that's not because the law courts are unable to act. It's because the people have not taken over to the extent of saying we must have it.
Well, would you draw from this picture that we are not in danger of developing a very serious black separatist, black chauvinist movement in America?
The best proof is that the Muslim movement is gaining thousands of converts every day right here in New York City, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles. And I know of no city in the country where there is not at least a small group.
Then there is a widespread
Why,
loss of
faith. Certainly.
It's
not exactly a loss of faith, it's impatience. And if the people, I'm not talking about people in government alone, I'm talking about the people that control the community. If they would stand up as the one of the best examples a few years ago, a white parent in Brooklyn, New York, and it's the same thing. You always remember the name of bad people. You never remember the name of good people. At least I tend to forget them. I would like to remember her name. There's a white woman who wrote to the school board and said, my daughter is going to a school that is entirely white from top to bottom. There are no Negro students in it, and I want to know why. Now, if we could get people to do that, and we have it north as well as south. In the north, we have great people that say it's a shame what's happening to the Negro in Mississippi and Alabama. It's a shame what they're doing to him in Georgia and Florida. But what was that you said, Negro to live beside me? Oh, well, now that's a different problem.
Well, I wonder whether one could draw an analogy between the justified impatience of the Negro and on the other hand, the real progress, also slow progress, is made on racial justice and the economic justice that we had in the early days of industrialism, early 19th mm-hmm. century industrialism, where communism first got its hold in the European culture. And that was justified. I mean, when people are victims of injustice, racial or economic, this is a justified rebellion. Nevertheless, democracy gradually, by tortuous process, got a tolerable solution, a tolerable solution of the economic problem, and you, by a gradual process, I think are getting a tolerable solution. It takes much longer than we expected 30 years ago, 50 years ago, or what have you. But nevertheless, we have both those things, a justified impatience by the victims of injustice.
But I can say that here, and you can say that here, but can you tell the Negro in Mississippi?
No,
you can't explain it to him.
No, I don't want to.
That's what worries me. We don't have the time that Riney's been talking about. We did have the time. We hadn't got H-bombs and all the rest of it then. We do not have the time. And furthermore, the Negro is now confronted with the most shocking situation. We stand up in the world and say we're the champions of democracy. And then we treat him as we have treated him and are as slow as we are. Our democracy is mostly an opposition. It's mostly, I'm afraid, a rationalization of our own power politics. Not wholly, but mostly. And when we fight our modern devil, which is communism, when we fight that devil, we are inclined instinctively and otherwise to imitate him. It is, you are supposed to be most patriotic when you come nearest to communism in your attitude toward things you don't like in the expression of your bigotries. I think you will find pretty uniformly that the John Birch Society is a society that's very bigoted on race. But they say that their great business in life is fighting communism. They fight it in ways that would make people, if I was an African, say, well, communism probably is pretty good. This is the thing that's wrong.
Well, Mr. Thomas, I would say, without challenging your basic thesis, that the John Birch Society is in relationship to communism exactly what the black Muslims are in relationship to the problem of racial justice. And thank God, though they're important and growing, that they're still...
I can't accept that because the black Muslims have a lot of justification and the John Birch Society has... no justification that I can see.
That's a good...
The real trouble that we're all in opposition to the Muslims, is that their factual basis is correct. I have yet to find a statement of fact made. It's not correct. They say 6% have been integrated, that today there are places where a Negro can buy a home in the North. There are schools in Harlem that are completely Negro, et cetera, et cetera. The only thing I disagree is their...
Conclusions.
Yeah. But they are actually... Their factual base is correct, and the best way to run them out of business is to make the factual situation incorrect.
Well, the factual basis in terms of specific progress is incorrect, but their facts in regard to the complex things of community are wrong. Because they say... just as the communist says, there is an absolute class struggle between the owners and the workers.
Well, they're wrong on that.
They say, yes, they say there's an absolute struggle between the white man and the black man. Now,
they say all landlords are bad, and I know quite a few Negro landlords who are not.
Exactly. So if you realize that the whole of human history is a complex web of mutualities and conflicts, you know that this is factually wrong, but to say there's only conflict between white and Negro,
but
or only conflict.
The point is, I remember in World War II, a man who was a brigadier general, and in the middle of the war, when everybody had respect for uniform, and certainly you'd have considerable respect for uniform with a star on the shoulder, and he was crossing one of the streets in downtown Washington, and a truck was making a right-hand turn and almost ran him down. The truck was, of course, completely in the wrong. It happened to be a Negro driving the truck. And instead of saying, I'm sorry, he cussed the man out and told me he had no business being in my way. Well, the general didn't understand it. Nobody understood. I understood it. Because there are some Negroes who have been kicked around all of their life down south. And they just, anything that's the same color as the person that's been kicking them around, they resent. So, this Muslim group goes to people who have had this constant persecution, and then they find a simple solution. But it is not that simple.
That's exactly.
Well,
it's
you
not
see,
that simple.
There's your real trouble, and I think it's very sad, although wholly understandable.
Sure, it's sad.
What the Negro really wants is integration. What the black Muslim says is the solution
segregation.
Is segregation. What the Negro I thought wanted was to be treated like everybody else, have the same opportunities, the same standards of judgment. What the black Muslim says they want is 5 or 6 separate states, which they can't get. And anyway, I heard Malcolm X suggest that God was going to give it to them, which I seriously doubt. This is the thing that troubles me. That is to say that you get once more the wrong reaction. The reaction to the great injustice the Negro suffers is justice within the America in which he's born. It is equality of right. It is not another form of separation. It is not another form of segregation. And it seems to me that not only ethics, but in the long run, common sense would make that plain. You see, here it is that we often have the right emotions, the right reactions, and have so little analyzed the methods we use. There was ground for some objection to Castro, although I hated, loathed, and despised what was done in that Cuban revolt. But the reaction was wrong. You've got us all brought up with the ancient traditions of war, and all of a sudden we come to a time when we're told by our rulers that war is unthinkable, and then we think about it all the time. We live in a world where our instinctive, our traditional reactions are a great many times at variance with what common sense, if you thought long enough, and the demands of the situation require. Black Muslim illustrates it, but so do a great many of our foreign policies.
Here's our problem. Right here at this table, we are now gradually getting too blamed practical. We talk, I brought it up, about what the African nations, the Asian nations, looking at us. So we treat the Negro right in this country and give him his rights so that we'll have a good picture in the world today. Now we're on the subject that if the best way to get rid of the Muslims is to cure this Negro problem in the country. What I'm afraid of now, I'm in that same line of thinking. But I think it's typical that the reason we should give every citizen in this country his rights is not for any reason of that sort. It's because that each one of us should want to do it because we live in a democracy and it's morally right to do it.
Let me say amen and amen. You understand it. I'm not sure whether Riney does, but I'll say amen and amen to that.
I don't
sentiment.
Know why you challenge me on this, but I'll challenge you on the basis where I'm more optimistic than you are. You, on the Cuban situation, you seem to think that this is the reaction was terrible. Now, I'm rather optimistic about that because a very popular young president who had the Gallup polls all with him has had an almost universal reaction of criticism on the Cuban venture. That's, to me, a very hopeful sign about the state of mind of the American people. Universal reaction.
No, I've been around a good deal, and I don't read it that way. The almost universal reaction is because it failed. That is to say, the people say, well, how badly messed it was. What happened to the CIA? And, of course, the CIA's role was terrible. But I do not find that there is this universal reaction against the essential falsehoods, which poor Stevenson was forced to tell, against the essential error, the profound error of believing that this is a situation that could be used by the application of unilateral force. I wish I did.
Mr. Thomas, you mentioned the lack of a left. Mr. Marshall's dissent has been of a different nature, but I'm sure he's accepted and accepts himself as a figure of dissent. Now, I've read, and everybody else has read, all the descriptions of the disappearance of dissent in America. But I'm never satisfied with them, and I doubt if anybody else is satisfied with them. What is the comment of you men on that? I noticed in your case, Mr. Marshall, you were tending toward the picture of a kind of a middle-class society growing.
Well, I can give one example. I don't know. But everybody was so glorified in the passage of the minimum wage of $1.25, and everybody just completely ignored the tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of people that were deliberately cut out of it. Such as the laundry workers in the South and others of that type. And I just wonder how much of the real, true dissent we have. You don't see it in the papers. You don't see it in the press.
Well, now, what's
that
happened?
That point, but... for example, I only saw it in one paper. I'm not saying it wasn't in others, but...
But you yourself, in your career, have lived through a period of vigorous dissent on every conceivable issue. What's
I get mine from both sides and all sides. So in our work, I don't think it's slowed down. There are people who say that they're using the same thing on the minority groups they use on the others. Get a good job and save some money and get a good education and intelligently vote. And all of a sudden, your rights will drop down in your lap. And that's real modern thinking. That's all the way back to Booker Washington. That's how modern that is.
Well, let me say something about this. Well, we're all left of center, say. Mr. Thomas probably wouldn't recognize me on the left.
My goodness, the center is so far right that Ryan'd have to be at the left.
I'd want to be, but... I want to say a word for the younger generation, the student generation, living in our kind of world. They're not leftists the way we were in our youth. Not that way. But they had glaring problems. In the Negro case, they've still got glaring problems, so it's different. But on the economic issue, the problems were much more glaring. They are relatively solved. Now, once we solve them, we got the new issue of... corruption in the labor unions, for instance. The labor unions are a very important instrument of solution for the economic problem, but they raise their own problems. Now, the young student that looks at this is going to look at it more circumspectly. He's under the danger of either evading it because it's so complex, or that he's going to be an organization man, as Mr. Marshall says. But at his best, he's not leftist in the way we were, but he's responsible. And I think remarkably responsible concerning the complexity of the issues.
I would agree that we have probably more, not fewer, more or less individual dissenters, more or less group dissenters on this issue or that. I think there's a good deal of hope, especially the last 2 years, largely stimulated by the sit-in strikers. There's been a change for the better in the colleges, which I see. Yeah. I think it's even good that to organize conservative clubs. It shows that the serpent of doubt has entered into the Eden of affluent society.
What a
paradise
that is!
That isn't my point. But the point is that we have gone so far away from any organization of it that there's no substantial organized left. And by that I don't mean that it would all have to be in one party or one union. But I am saying, and saying very sorrowfully, that there is no political group and there's scarcely any labor group that you can automatically trust to be in there fighting for the things that we now have been fighting for. I have been more discouraged than I can tell, and I'll say this to Thurgood Marshall. You know, your organizations are so respectable that on several occasions they wouldn't let me speak. I'm telling you. Now, I'm not quarreling. If that helps you win, God bless you. But what I am quarreling with is the extraordinary weakness with which the liberals and labor yielded on civil rights legislation, on many other things. What I am quarreling with is that there is now no automatic response to speak of from labor on issues. On Cuba, for instance, it's a terrible thing to a socialist to find labor so much less easily aroused than the middle class. It's a terrible thing that labor... made more fuss about the unorganized and what can be done. I want to second what Thurgood Marshall has said. This minimum rights, minimum wage legislation leaves out everybody who needs it most.
Right. And they gave in deliberately to the Southern conservative
They
bloc.
Certainly did. The migratory workers as a whole are the worst in America.
That's
are
right.
out. The laundry workers. I can tell you about a laundry strike I was once... involved in the South. They're out. The waiters, especially if they're colored, are out.
Well, that's the reason they're out.
You see, there is nothing. This is the thing that grinds my spirit.
But, of course, what a lot of people would say is that you men began your careers in a period when there was a different set of values among the American people, A set different from what exists now, and you know the rest of the argument. Our society has changed in a way where there is no value that attaches importance, significance, prestige to dissent, to individualism, and so forth. But you men don't really accept that, I gather.
No. That isn't it. That's a very superficial answer. Look,
well, I mean,
I'm a dissenter that circulates. I worry about the general degree of personal approval I get. Well, after all, you know, they have a mistaken idea that I won lots more than I ever did, even though I'm the most beat man in America.
Well, no,
it's deeper. I don't think that. I don't think that in my youth that dissenters had any particular great respect as opposed to the present.
And they were on the whole futile compared to
Well, of course, it goes on from there to that people don't believe in anything anymore.
Well, that's a different thing.
Mr. Marshall, I think the thing
that worries me is the group of people that do not want to get involved in anything that does not directly involve them. Yeah. And I see that specifically that when there's a picket line or what have you, or there's a mob out in the street, there should be people going to the other side and deliberately taking a position on it. And we don't see it. They take their position in their home or in their meeting or by adopting a resolution or something. But I mean, to actually stand out and say that before you club this man, you've got to club me.
Well, Mr. Niebuhr, now this is your territory, this second point. Not to the lack of individualism, but the change in values itself. And well, I remember your being around this table, and I think you were beginning to talk as we ended that day about what you believe certain fundamental changes in values are in this country. Am I correct?
Well, yes, I think that picture is mixed about values. Take, for instance, the old value of ordinary honesty, without which any society goes to pieces, particularly democratic society. Now, you have the reaction to the quiz show rigging.
Yes.
And the dishonesty in labor unions.
You mean
and
people
management.
Were not shocked? Is that what you mean?
No,
I wasn't shocked.
Some people were not shocked.
I said
that's why it's
were.
Mixed.
Well, I was.
Well, some people were. Now, for instance, in the quiz show rigging, I was surprised and rather shocked by the fact that some of the university students said, well, what's so wrong about that? Everybody's doing it. Now, that's the cynical reaction.
I see.
But I see.
Yeah, I agree with you on
but
that.
But I wouldn't be too too pessimistic about that, because I think, on the whole, the standards of honesty are not better than they were. But let me put it like this. The standards of honesty, granted the collectivist character of a modern technical society, are probably better than they were. I remember that years ago in my youth, we elected the mayor of Detroit, Senator Cousins, who was Ford's partner.
Mm-hmm.
And when he went to Washington, he said, what I'm cheered about is that people react against dishonesty in government, which is not as bad as this dishonesty in business that we've had all the time that I've been in business. He says the kickbacks and all these things. So this is a rather perpetual problem of human experience.
I'm not even sure this is a very valuable part of a debate. If I were on a college debating team, I wouldn't care which side you asked me to debate as to whether we're better or worse than our forefathers or better or worse than my... I'm concerned that we're so much less good than we ought to be. And in view of the greater demands, our mistakes, our sins can cost us so much more. It's so much more dangerous to get into a war now when you've got H-bombs than it was even at the Civil War level or the First World War level.
Well, Mr. Thomas,
and I'm also, and here's where the need of honesty does come in, and the lack of it is so great. And I think the reason is because of a kind of cynicism that has kept over. It's perhaps cynicism a little too strong. Because we did, many of us, hope too much or advertised our hopes too much, because democracy hasn't come through the way we had hoped, because for political reasons we have to call any nation free that isn't communist, youth and older people are without a sense that values will work.
That's
a trouble.
Well, how do you, for example, How can you persuade a young law school graduate in the South who's going to run for state legislature and who has his sights set on at least governor or possibly U.S. senator, and persuade him that it is to his political benefit to take the side of the underdog? You can't persuade him of that because you have no examples for him.
Well, you never could persuade him as far as that's concerned. Look at all the Southern liberals who have been liberal in the international scene or national scene, who weren't straight on the race issue because that was their seat of power. I know that Mr. Thomas will challenge me on this as a bit of cynicism, but I think that we have to recognize that politics is now, as it always been, a morally very inexact business because it deals with power realities. And it's not that we're better or worse in any generation, but we haven't come to terms with the fact that politics is, I won't say slightly, but more or less dishonest. And I don't know of anybody that gets power without a certain amount of dishonesty.
But this is the trouble. You see, the getting of power, it's a different story than it used to be. I know Machiavelli myself. He couldn't keep out of jail, by the way. And I don't know anything in Machiavelli that makes an editorial I read in the Times on the need of talking the truth invalid. And when I think that we are now talking not only in terms of ordinary politics, but the kind of extension of politics which war means, in terms where if it is on a large scale, it comes close to obliteration, and that people come home from church and soberly sit down and discuss how well we're doing. When I think that the climax of a speech of a famous educator who I heard was that we should not be safe until the Russians know that if they destroy half of us, we can destroy two-thirds of them. If that's true, let's look at it. But let's not look at it in the way and in the spirit he did, and let's know the consequences of life when you have to look at the world that way. Here is what I'm quarreling with.
Gentlemen, we only have 10 minutes left here, and I would like to get this in. Back in the 30s, this period by which we measure a lot of these things, there was, of course, the great battle over foreign policy in America. And, Mr. Thomas, I was reading back over your statements in that period, and of course, we all know your foreign policy views at that time, and you said, in my judgment, there is not enough difference between the kind and quality of totalitarian rule under Stalin and the quality of statism under Hitler to justify the death of a generation of American youth. And after Pearl Harbor, if I understand the quotations correctly, you said you still do not want to continue this war indefinitely, only to the end that Stalin may become lord over most of Europe and Asia. Now, I don't want to revive any old foreign policy quarrels. I'm not interested in that at all. What I do want to raise is the question here, did we somewhere or another go wrong nation with respect to the world?
We went wrong. I'm not justifying all I said. Let that be out of the way.
I just use this to provoke.
But after Pearl Harbor, certainly, I do justify practically everything I said. It's one of the few periods of my life that I'm willing to try to do it. What I said was that you couldn't get the peace we want by talking unconditional surrender. What I said was that you couldn't get peace by appeasing Stalin to the degree that he was appeased. What I said was that you couldn't get a desirable peace in the Far East without promising the peoples of the Far East something else than the breaking of the Japanese yoke.
But did we specifically go wrong at any place, let's say, from the early 1900s, to the present, or are these mistakes in details?
No, the details are awfully large, but I don't think there was any specific place between the 1900 and now we went wrong because we weren't right enough to go wrong. That's why.
No.
And because the things that I thought in that time were the sufficient cure weren't quite sufficient because we hadn't thought it through because they're a little too simple. But that doesn't mean for an instant that I'm not profoundly thankful that we won. In the field of child labor, in labor generally, in the right to organize. I think that we hardly ever... We did some right things, but never consistently right. And we never did anything as right as the Marshall Plan.
Mr. Niebuhr?
Well, that's true, but I'm a little worried about putting these purely moral categories for these ambiguous international
politics. I had a feeling you would be.
Because, take, for instance, when Hitler invaded Russia, Churchill immediately went on the radio in order to declare a common cause, and he said, if the devil is going my way, I'll go with him. Now, that's a very dangerous thing to say. On the whole, I think it was right that we were allied with Russia, terrible as that was, and incidentally, none of the statesmen anticipated, or if they did, they didn't confess that we would have these terrible problems with the Cold War that we had. But it was necessary that we have an alliance. The Eichmann trial.
Oh, I didn't charge. I didn't deny that.
But I mean, I'm simply emphasizing the fact that the alliances of politics, particularly international politics, that the wisdom of hindsight doesn't really cover the issues as they were faced by the statement by a Churchill or by an FDR.
Yeah, but the wisdom of hindsight ought to help us for the present. And what worries me profoundly is the educational, the moral, the practical effect of our practical identification of the word free to with non-communist.
But you mean by our being basically wrong is that we did not drive over those years for world disarmament, for example.
And for a world federation.
And Mr. Niebuhr, you were saying that's a kind of utopian foreign policy that does not recognize the realities of power. Is that a rough
thing? I say that's an ultimate goal, but we're not...
Unless you have an ultimate goal, we're lost. That's just it. We need desperately now, and the ruck we're in, to have an ultimate goal that is vivid and clear, and that we go to work intelligently to get. That's one trouble.
Mr. Marshall, on this foreign policy business, may I draw you in here? Have we, in some way or another, misunderstood the world, even in its simplest phases? Now, we have pretty clear the difference between Mr. Niebuhr and Mr. Thomas, but I noticed when you went over to Kenya, and there's some very amusing quotes from you. You said that having been over here and trying to protect the white man's rights in Kenya, I understand better the problem in Indiana, and so forth and so on.
Very good quote.
Are you saying here that we've all been guilty of a kind of incredible naivete in the world?
Well, I think this on the foreign relations field, my last trip there, in talking to the representatives of about 8 countries over there. We have created a blackjack for ourselves.
In Africa?
Yeah. They now take the stage that since you always bend over backward to help countries that lean toward Russia, do we have to lean toward Russia to get some help?
Yeah,
that's what they say.
They then say, well, we heard what President Kennedy said about assistance, economic and otherwise. But what we want to know is how much, when, and where. I think that our basic philosophy is that that's our old financial philosophy. We put out some dollars and that'll do it. I believe the only way to win the world toward democracy, and I don't mean necessarily in contrast to Russia, I would say the same thing if Russia were not there, that we've got to do more demonstrating, and I think that's where we've been off base. I don't believe that. I still think that there are people in our government, I know there are people in Congress, that consider that if we have to do it, we'll just have to give some more billions in foreign aid. That's all we have to do.
Are you saying, you'd say it, never mind about Russia, and I would too, would you say it, never mind about some others on the other side, Spain, Nicaragua, Santo Domingo, I mean, the Dominican
Republic.
Well,
that's our problem in South America today.
And that's what we don't say. We don't effectively say democracy in opposition to them. I'm not advocating wars or intervention by force, but I'm saying we've never used our weight morally and economically as we should.
We never have.
Any quarrel there? No quarrel.
I think it's worth saying that we had a really creative policy in Latin America where we're going to use our economic power to beguile the Latin American nations to something better than their feudal system. What I think was so disastrous about the Cuban venture is that it overwhelmed that whole plan.
And I agree with you.
This... Not that alone. That,
but
that,
the first...
That was the last move. There were a lot of other...
I don't want to be sound as if I was only criticizing my own country. One of the troubles of Latin America is that it's awfully hard to cooperate if you have to cooperate with governments which have the kind of tax and land laws which maintain year in and year out so narrow an elite as we've got. I don't think that we're worse than the rest of the world by any means, and I want to put that on record. On the other hand, I don't think that we're saved by because we're not as bad as communists.
You know, as I've listened to this discussion, it has a peculiar mixing of optimism and pessimism.
Well, that's why I'm here. If I was wholly as pessimistic as I am sometimes, I wouldn't have bothered to come to your meeting.
Is this it? Is this it?
Well, I'm afraid I have more optimism than pessimism.
Considering the complexity of the world scene and the national scene, I think the only proper attitude is a combination of pessimism
right.
and optimism.
I think so. And I don't think you can be quite logical, at least make it sound quite logical, when you're faced with such an extraordinary mixture of facts. Have I time to tell a story?
Quick,
and say this. I was in Seattle, and it was the day before Easter, and I was in a lunchroom getting coffee or something, and a very nice, amiable old grandfather, not so old, was talking to countermen. He was talking about two things in the same breath. One, how nice he was going to be to his grandchildren. He was giving
I'm
them ducks.
Afraid, Mr. Thomas,
and the other really was that he liked the John Birch Society. That's
sorry.
What worries me.
Thank you, Mr. Niebuhr, Mr. Marshall, and Mr. Thomas, and pardon me, I had to cut you off.